When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, there's something special with a propeller plane. As a kid, I always loved Indiana Jones. And I admit it, to me, Indy is still in many ways the essence of adventures. I've hummed the theme song countless times. And Indiana always flew in with a propeller plane, always. Either that or a inflatable life raft down a mountainside. And here I am, in a propeller plane heading north. Adventure lies ahead in the sense that I don't really know what to expect. I'm about to meet up with Sigurdur Jonsson, captain of the sailboat Aurora Arctica, a man that I first saw in the fantastic Iceland episode from the Skier's Journey video series by Jordan Manley. My name is Magnus Ormestad, and this is the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. I land in the small town of Ísafjörður, the ice fjord, a town of some 3,000 people in the northwest of Iceland, in the region called the Westfjords. Ísafjörður lies nested deep in the fjord, with snow-covered mountains on both sides. The mountains are so close that it probably, in theory, would be possible to ski all the way from the top down to the city center. It's a beautiful town. The surroundings are unbelievable. The ocean, the mountains, but also the town itself, where many of the wooden houses are more than 120 years old and painted in bright colors. When I arrive around lunchtime on Sunday, two things have happened. First of all, according to most of the Icelanders, spring has just arrived. Second, it has been snowing constantly for about a week. We throw my gear into Siggy's car, and within 1 hour I'm putting the skins on my splitboard, and together with the local backcountry community, we get two nice runs in poor visibility, but in great powder snow. This is also my first introduction to the very active, social and warm backcountry community of Ísafjörður. Later that evening, I join them for movie night at the local cafe Bredraborg that serves as kind of a headquarter and hangout for the visitors and locals seeking inspiration, company or just great food. I start talking to Caitlin, Ali and Cam. Three Americans with a kick-ass camper van parked outside.
So what kind of group is this?
We're three skiers, photographers, riders, storytellers on an adventure through Iceland, skiing and camping.
How come you ended up at the Westfjords?
I think I had seen some content coming out of this area from other people, but not much. And I think Iceland's been doing a really great job of promoting itself and its tourism. And this just seemed like one of the areas in Iceland that was least visited, just because of where it is geographically. And it did have some promising ski terrain. So those two things coupled together just made for a good opportunity for us as skiers and people who were looking to create some content.
But none of you had ever been here before?
No. Nope.
What was like the first impressions coming here, coming to Iceland and coming up here, up north?
Well, initially I kind of have always felt like Iceland is kind of a last frontier in some ways. The weather and winter is definitely still strong here. And so initially getting here, I was kind of astounded with the rawness that we felt, and the way that, obviously we know that this country doesn't have a huge population, but it also has kind of some really raw and true people that are, I think, really hardy and able to deal with adversity and then turn it into this positive thing. And so initially, actually, we got this mentality kind of overwhelming, a lot of people telling us, oh, this is easy, Iceland is easy, everything is so easy. And we actually found it to be pretty, well, I don't even know how to put this in there, because we have been enjoying it, but it's been, in some ways it can be difficult.
Building character.
Building character, yeah. And so getting to Ísafjörður, has been an adventure, and it's exactly what we signed up for.
And so what's your setup here? You got a massive trailer parked outside, a camper Iceland.
Yeah, we've got the Dodge Ram 1500.
Of course, the favorite.
Yeah, of course. with a small camper on the bed of the truck. So it came equipped with heat and two burner stove and enough space for three people to sleep fairly comfortably. I don't think it was quite ready to absorb all the massive amounts of gear we brought, so it's a bit of a logistical feat every day of like taking our gear out and drying it out and, you know, prepping it for living in, especially with the weather we've been having. So considering it's summer as well, at least that's what the Icelandics keep telling us.
The powder summer.
Yeah.
What could you say about the terrain? How accessible has it been? What kind of terrain have you been riding?
Well, this weather has made it kind of difficult for us to really see the tops of some of these zones where we'd like to go skiing. But the little bit that we have seen is extremely accessible, right from the road, and big. We're seeing lines that we'd like to ski and realizing that they top out at a pretty high elevation and something that looks aesthetically pleasing as well as challenging. Then there's stuff inside these valleys that you can tour for a couple hours and then get to some zones that look like skiing I would really want to do. So once this weather breaks, I can't wait to tackle some of these objectives and ski some zones that just look like fun, really fun.
Is your knowledge and your experience, is that enough? Or do you also work with, like, is it just maps and your experience that's enough? Or do you feel like you need like written guides or groups or anything?
Yeah, I think at this point, the skiing hasn't really been touched enough. And so skiing lines right from the road, some are first ascents. And that's pretty incredible. So you don't need a map. However, there are some areas that offer some great skiing that are even further into these valleys off the road that I think with a guide and with the assistance, you could really get into some zones that you can't do on your own without.
So what's the expectations and hopes for the next coming days?
I've had the mentality of have no expectations but expect great things. So we're hoping that the weather breaks and we just get to really see the potential of the area and get on our skis, because as of now we've been staring at them and spending some time in the cafes. But to have some weather that at least allows us to get up and ski some couloirs. I mean, as Caitlin was just saying, the the skiing just looks incredibly aesthetic and something that we're all very excited to do and ski right down to our truck and leave from the road. So it'd be
and fill it up with stinking clothes. Oh, stinking clothes.
Hopefully. Well, I mean, I think we've already achieved that. But,
and we've only been sitting around. Just wait till we start skiing. Uh-oh.
It takes another day before I finally get aboard the Aurora Arctica. Aboard, Captain Siggy explains a bit about life on board.
Okay. So, I'm just going to do a quick safety housekeeping briefing. First of all, close to all of your bunks are these kind of life jackets in red pockets on the wall. So, if we are just motoring around quietly, you don't need to be wearing them. But if we are sailing, and we should be wearing a life jacket. If I'm wearing a life jacket, it's a good hint that you should be wearing one as well. They are all like this. Just clip this one in here. Get this one under here, and there's these lifelines are also in the pockets. You may not need them, but let's say if you want to be climbing onto the front when the boat is jumping around, you should be keeping your lifelines, and then you can clip onto things. For instance, there's a white webbing that runs all the way up and back that you can clip onto, so you can walk up and down the boat without unclipping. Or if you're sitting in the cockpit, you can clip onto some of the D-rings that are sitting in the cockpit. So it's a good thing to have. So these life jackets are automatic. So if you do fall in, they should pop up within a few seconds. If they don't, there's a toggle. But I put them kind of under the Velcro here. May not be the official way to do it, but you just tear open the Velcro and pull these toggles. I just want to keep them under here, otherwise they get accidentally pulled all the time. But this will usually pop up within a few seconds. If none of this works, there's also a tube that you can blow into and blow it up. But most importantly, do not fall overboard. That's the number one. It's cold and wet, uncomfortable and unpopular.
The days on the boat are just perfect, just what I came for. The essence of the good and simple life. Breakfast, hop into the Zodiacs for a day of ski touring, and at least one long run in the untracked snow down to the waiting boat and a delicious dinner. With the boat, we access the Hornstrandir Nature Reserve. In Hornstrandir, I finally get to see the Arctic fox for the first time. Kind of a big thing for me since it's almost extinct in Scandinavia. At the end of the week, I sit down with the Siggy. The fjord lies still like a mirror around us. No wind, no clouds, just the birds and in the end, even a barking fox.
What can you say about this boat that we're sitting on? And if you allow yourself to be very sailboat nerdy, what can you say about it?
I don't know. For a sailboat nerd, I would say it's an old-fashioned British kind of a boat. She was designed for a round-the-world race for amateurs. So she was designed to be very conservative. She's got a very old-fashioned feel about it. But Robin Knox Johnston, the guy I bought the boat from, he said that she was designed agriculturally, you know, strong for amateurs to crash jibe in the Southern Ocean without damaging anything. So she's simple and strong. And I'm not that it's sailboat nerdy, but I like to say that she's more like a Land Rover. She's not a Porsche, you know, she's more like a Land Rover. It's a working boat, more than a yacht.
When you did find it, did you find the boat that you were looking for, or was it just convenient?
Well, I wasn't actually even looking for a boat. It was a kind of a coincidence how everything happened. So I had basically had this in mind for probably 20, 30 years, and I had been doing similar trips on my own little boat, for just my own, with my friends. We'd been going skiing and climbing and stuff from a boat. And I had moved back from Canada, but back from Ísafjörður, and was working freelance for Canadian companies in shipbuilding projects. And then I met Robin Ox Johnston, who was in Ísafjörður with Chris Bonington on this boat. And we were sitting down below and having some chicken curry and beer, and I suggested to Robin that he would leave the boat in Ísafjörður because he had a crew to take her back to England. And he said, well, yeah, okay, that's a good idea, you know, because he had to go back. He couldn't get to Greenland. He had to come back later somehow and finish it. But then he said, why don't you just buy her? She's for sale. You can, you know, take her and do it yourself. So that, of course, nothing happened then, but that triggered that idea. And I basically, they left, sailed back to England. But that gave me the idea to really go and look into it, and I had some friends with me, and so we basically started to make up some kind of a business plan to see if we would actually go bankrupt on this or not. And so that's eventually we decided to make an offer on this boat and buy her. So it was it was more the boat came to me than me finding the boat, you know.
And that was back in 2000. And
that's in 2005, in the spring, in the summer of 2005. And the next winter, we kind of got it together and picked her up in Portsmouth in April 2006.
And you got to name the boat?
Yeah, she was, because she was used for the races. She never really had the same name all the time. She had like sponsor names. And Aurora is a good name. It's a woman's name in many languages, and it's many famous boats that have had that name, and it's the rosy fingered goddess of dawn. So it's a beautiful name, I think. Fits to what we're doing.
And she's been around the world, what, 4 or 5 times?
Yeah, so she was around the world in the race 4 times before I got her. So, yeah. She was, but in a warm place, mostly.
But about warm places, you are not from a warm place.
No.
Sometimes it's warm, I guess, but...
Yeah, and I'm from... So I'm basically born and raised here and lived most of my life here.
And here is Ísafjörður.
Yeah, in the West Fjords of Iceland, in Ísafjörður. So, yeah, I would... you're right, that's probably not a warm place.
Do you go long back in the West Fjords, your family?
Yeah, actually, my family goes many generations in the town of Ísafjörður, actually. It's maybe a bit unusual. But...
What kind of town is it?
Well, it's primarily a fishing town. And... it's still very much a fishing town. It's still like Ísafjörður is also a service center for the area, but it's first and foremost the West Fjords are based on fishery, and I was working in shipyards or in shipbuilding and this kind of projects, you know, when I was younger, and that's what I did also after college.
But what was it like growing up in a place like Ísafjörður?
I thought it was always fantastic. And I thought I lived in the center of the universe, really.
And I still, you know, I was 20 years old when somebody pointed out that there was a small fishing village. I had no idea. I thought it was, you know, I was always talking about, you know, it was like us, and then it was maybe somebody in Reykjavik, but mostly like New York, London, Paris, you know. We were, you know, we who lived in these cities, you know, these metropolis. So I always thought I lived in one of the major cities of the world. And in a way, I kind of still think so. You can put you could put the center of the universe wherever you put your finger, you know?
Yeah.
So if you... And Ísafjörður has always been a kind of a cultural hub. And it's been bigger than it is, really. Not only, you know, in people's mind, you know, people have always imagined it a little bit bigger than it is. It's been a very rich culture of music. It's been a skiing town, of course, but in basically still a fishing town.
Because we now I'm glad to say I have first-hand experience of it, but it's actually a town where you can ski like right almost from the middle of the city. You can go skiing more or less. So is that has that always been like a big part of it growing up there?
The winter. Yes, I think so. I mean, it's. Not necessarily skiing, but you know, for me, it's always been something about the combination of the water and the mountains. So I've always been around boats in some way. You know, my father had small boats. I used to go kayaking, and then we had sailboats, and I used to work in a shipyard. So I was always around the sea and the boats. And then also, there's a rich kind of a skiing culture in my family. I was never really a very good skier, but I was always skiing, and I was very much in the mountains, you know, a lot of camping and climbing and stuff. So everything was very accessible, you know, within, you know, 10 minutes you could be in ice climbing above the town, or another 10 minutes the other way you would be out kayaking. So I think, yeah, it was a very important part of my life.
And it's never was like when it comes to like identity, for instance, like choosing between the waters, the oceans, or the mountains and stuff. It was always like a combination of both.
Yeah, for me and many of my friends, it was never really any conflict. You know, of course, there's a lot of people that are, you know, come from the skiing background and they never had anything to do with the sea. But I think, for me and many of my friends and family, we were always linking these two things together. And also, I think, yeah, I think it's, yeah, yeah.
It's. I guess this could be a very difficult question, but like, where is there any place that you feel more at home? And also, like, if you're, say, you are. You are sailing in a coastal area, but far away from the mountains, and vice versa. If you're in the mountains, but you kind of lack the closeness of water and oceans, is that something that you you consider, you think about?
Yeah, I, for instance, I moved to Denmark. I went to college in Denmark. I studied like naval architecture in Denmark, so I lived there for 4 years, and I definitely missed the mountains, and I felt like fish out of the water in a way. You know, I've never felt really at home there, and there was a lot of things missing. It was nice and cute, you know. Denmark is organized and cute, but it's not very exciting. And I needed that connection to, you know, to the mountains and the sea.
What is the excitement? What is excitement for you? What did you miss?
I kind of missed a little bit the same things from the nature as from the people. It's a bit unstructured, unorganized, impulsive environment. And I think Icelanders are still struggling to get into the kind of the modern society. Because we are used to, and even more when you get out into the rural parts of Iceland, like Ísafjörður, you're very much, I guess we could say, maybe in tune with the nature. Is that nature rules, and that means that nature always has the last word. It doesn't matter if you're flying to Reykjavik, if you're driving to Reykjavik, if you're organizing a wedding party or whatever, if you're organizing anything, you can do all your best in any organizing, but it's always the nature that's going to have the final word. And I think it does create, if people get used to it and get comfortable with it, I think they develop a kind of a stoic attitude towards their environment and life. And it's so the weather is bad. Okay, there's nothing we can do about it. We'll just deal with it and adapt to it. And that attitude also goes into, you know, other things in life, is that, you know, you develop some kind of a stoic attitude towards, you know, these things, and you kind of relaxed about it. But then, on the other hand, you have to be a bit impulsive. Okay, the sun is shining, we have to do something, you know, we have to take in the hay, or we have to go fishing, because the good weather is good. So we have to seize the opportunity. And that is, so it goes all the way from nature, but it also goes down into what people... I think that's one of the things that have been a bit of a problem for Icelanders in the modern, you know, economies, like running banks and stuff. People thought they could, you know, they went straight from being fishermen to running banks, and they thought they could run the banks in the same way, you know, just be very good, you know, good at the work and work, but not really look at the long term, slow strategies and organizations. And of course, it didn't work so well.
So that's part of the explanation for the like 2008, 2009 crash. Could be that the influence of nature or something.
Yeah, I think so. I think it has. I think that little impulsiveness in people definitely had an impact. Is that if you are a fisherman, when the fishing was good and the weather was good, you really have to work hard and make tons of money, because maybe next year it would all collapse, and then you had to survive. So the whole economy in Iceland has been a roller coaster, up and down with the fishery for the longest time. Of course, now it's much more stable. We have tourism, we have all kinds of other industries that are very stable. But people came into banking. You know, I think
money was good, so they like did everything they could to.
Yeah, you were. You were working hard and spending the money when you had it, because maybe tomorrow you didn't have it.
But have you experienced this clash for yourself? Like you already said, you've been living in Denmark and you've been living in the US. Have you experienced this clash firsthand? Like, did you find it a bit more difficult to adapt to these?
Yeah, I find it very difficult. And I basically now I'm older and more mature, and I just basically said, okay, I'm not going to adapt. I'm just going to live where I can do it my way. I'm not going to try. I can't live in Denmark. There's no way, because I can't adapt to this kind of environment. I can't live in these, you know, structured, steady European countries that are so organized and settled. I just can't deal with that kind of environment. So I'm just going to live where I can, you know, do what I want to do. And
How come you ended up in Newfoundland?
Well, there was a kind of a coincidence. I started to go... So I was working in a shipyard in Ísafjörður for many years, and then I worked for a company making fish processing machinery. And I started in probably 97, 98. I started to go to Canada to set up fish factories, shrimp factories mostly, and all kinds of projects. And then... eventually, we decided to set up a daughter company for an Icelandic company, a little stainless steel machine shop in St. John's in Newfoundland. So I moved. I basically took that project on and moved there for a year to set up the shop. And after I set it up and I hired some local guys to run it, one of my biggest clients offered me a job to restructure a fleet of fishing trawlers. So I moved over to that company, a big Canadian, it was at that time the biggest fishing company in Canada, a huge company.
Did you feel at the time that you were taking a risk, like leaving Iceland behind for a moment, putting it on pause and then
no,
take something on?
Never really. I mean, I've always... I kind of looked at it as a temporary project, which it was in a way. I was always hired on a temporary basis, kind of a project basis. So I in a way, I never looked at it that I had actually moved. I thought, okay, I'm just going to go away for a while, but I'm on my way back, you know.
What did you find in Newfoundland, except work wise, like with the society and the nature and everything?
Well, nature is in some ways similar to here. The people are fantastic, really nice culture. You know, the people are really nice. They have their own political issues, and they have a lot of interesting dilemmas with their connection with Canada. You know, they are still kind of a little like a little British colony, and maybe a little independent country that has kind of been sucked into Canada. So they are struggling quite a lot in finding their place within Canada. But absolutely fantastic people, and I enjoyed every day that I was there. I miss it a little bit, you know. I miss the people, and I miss the connection with Newfoundland. But, it was a great experience. I had my family there, my kids went to school, and it was just fantastic.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But is that a kind of a rebellious attitude that you are, that you find yourself attracted to, interested in?
No, not at all. I don't look at it at all that I'm rebellious. I think I'm quite, but I've more and more tried to do my way, do things my way, you know, and do what I like. And I've also encouraged my kids to basically follow their hearts and do exactly what they like to do, and the in the way that they like. Of course, but if you want to do that, you have to be responsible. So if you want to be free, you have to be responsible and free. You can't just be, you know, rebellious in a way. It's not. So I don't really look at this any. I think I'm a fairly quiet citizen of my community. But I really like to do things my own way. But I'm willing to take that responsibility and do it in a proper way that it doesn't harm other people.
So it kind of came natural for you in a way to start your own business, like to be your own boss.
Yeah, in a way, I've always. So I'm a naval architect,
but you have been working as that.
Yeah, I've been working that, but for some reason, I always got kind of sucked into some kind of a management functions every now and then. I hated it. I didn't like the money. I don't like the business part of it. I really don't like the business part of it. But repeatedly, I kind of got sucked into business part of it. A shipyard went bankrupt in Ísafjörður, and I ended up being a director of a new shipyard and managing it for a few years. In Newfoundland, I came on as an engineer, but I ended up being a director of fleet operation with like a $60 million trawler operation and like a few hundred people working for me. So I got sucked into kind of a management, like a business management things, but I was never interested in the business part of it except as a project. I I try to do it properly.
Like to establish a vision and then kind of reach it.
Yeah, I looked at it. Okay, I have to do a good job. But I'm not in it because I'm interested in making money and stuff. You know, I'm just interested in fulfilling my work and doing it properly.
Is that something that you can connect to, like your outdoor activities, like going on not expeditions, but like going on like tours and climbing and stuff?
In some ways, yeah, maybe, because I think it's all about you are. Same in my business now. Now I'm totally independent in a way that I own Aurora and I operate her, and it's very important, I think, is to link the responsibilities with the authorities in a way. So I have full power over what I'm doing. I have full. I can do whatever I want, but it comes with responsibility. And the same thing is if you're climbing a difficult route, you're sailing across an ocean, you're free and independent, but you're never free and independent if you're not responsible at the same time. So it has to come together, I think.
What's your relation to taking risks, being in danger, being scared?
Yeah, I don't think I'm taking... I thought about it quite a lot, and I'm asked about it quite a lot, but I have never sought danger. I've done a lot of different things, you know, a lot of climbing, a lot of sailing in bad weather and in difficult conditions. But it's never been for the sake of seeking the risk. I always thought that I was... I think I'm pretty careful, and I think you can do a lot of very potentially dangerous things just by doing very, you know, you have to be just not careful. And so I'm not seeking the thrill of danger, but I'm still drawn to the thrill of the unknown, in a way, more so than the actual danger. So just going across to Greenland when it's full of ice, or especially going across back home in the fall when it's really stormy, I don't think I'm afraid, but I'm very excited. You know, I feel that I'm excited, you know, and it's, you know, you're always double-checking everything. And so it's, I don't know where, maybe I'm afraid, but I feel like it's because I'm very, you know, excited about it.
Do your guests feel the same bouncing around in the boat, being seasick?
I think I've been with a lot of people that have felt that we were doing something dangerous. But I've never had anybody actually totally panic with me. I think probably people have some confidence in what I'm doing. I don't know.
What's your vision with your business, with what you're doing?
Well,
what do you offer? To begin with, what is your business idea?
Yeah, well, my business idea is pretty much to give people possibilities to come out and play outside with me, you know, and my friends. So it's not necessarily about skiing, it's not about sailing, it's not about kayaking. It's not about these things, but it's about being outside in a kind of an autonomous way. You know, you're on a boat, you have the freedom to go different places that you can't access any other way. And you are, yeah, basically I like to offer people that opportunity to come out and play with me. And that's really the core, I think.
If you look at the customers that you have, what do you hear from them? What is it with this operation that customers appreciate the most, do you think?
I think most people appreciate like that personal attention and connection, and to be shown some interesting things. It's not, like I said before, they're not going to go back and say this was the best skiing in my life. But they're going to say, okay, this was fantastic skiing, but it was also the food was great, or the conversation around the table was really interesting, or we heard some, you know, nice stuff, you know, we saw some foxes, or the birds were great, or, and that whole package all has to come together, in my opinion.
I also asked you the other day, if, as a sailor, are you, don't you, because in what I thought, that if you are a sailor and if you own a boat, you want to sail around the world. But you said no, and you said you'd rather just, no, I forgot exactly what you said, but you'd rather just experience the...
Now I'm... I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm older and whatever. But I am more and more interested in going, let's say, deeper rather than wider. So I'm not interested in sailing around the world, but I'm really interested in exploring more and more about areas that are relatively close to me. You know, when I started this operation, I remember once I kind of put like a ruler in the middle of Ísafjörður and said, okay, I'm going to play in about like a 400 or 500 mile radius around home. You know, that's going to be my home grounds. And that includes most of Greenland, specifically East Greenland. It's Jan Mayen, it's the Faroe Islands, Scotland, you know, it could even be down to the Azores, but that's kind of my home radius. And I'm more and more, you know, even the fjords that we are in skiing here, I never grow tired of it, you know, and every trip is a little different. There's no trips exactly the same. You always see something new, something a little bit different. And like East Greenland is just an absolutely fantastic wilderness area.
What is it with Greenland? I've never been there, but everyone who has been there or has been working there has seen the same
thing. I think for Greenland, it's the whole, for me, it's the whole combination of this wild nature, which has that combination of very little vegetation, big mountains, a lot of ice, and really wild area with maybe not so much wildlife, but some interesting encounters with bears and seals and whales and stuff. But for me, just as important is the history of the culture of the people, you know, the Inuit or the Greenlanders' culture and the way they've lived there for, you know, thousands of years. And it's very, very interesting, I think. And that combination of exploring the land with the thought about the people who have been there before, you know, I think that's absolutely fantastic. And another interesting thing is that it's so close to us. Like Ísafjörður is the closest port to East Greenland. So it's like 30 hours, yeah. Like it's about 30 hours away. And if we go out today, in about 10 hours, we're going to be stuck on the ice. But it's so different. There's nothing like Iceland. It's just everything is totally, totally different.
And just looking around us at the, it's almost difficult to explain. We're sitting in the front of the Aurora Arctica and doing this interview, and it's it's not a cloud in the skies, and it's a late setting evening sun, and there's birds flying around us, and it's just, you know, it's almost too good to be true. But what can you say about the Westfjords, about your home area, your backyard?
Yeah, the Westfjords are, I mean, for the longest, I mean, people have lived here for 1,000 years, but it's always been kind of the extreme outer edge of Iceland in a way, you know, and people have been living here in really, really remote little cottages and in like subsistence farming. And it's only in the last 60, 70 years that people really started to collect into villages. And it was a booming time, like in the 70s, it was pretty, you know, it was a good boom in the fishery, and the villages was building up. But then with the reduction in the fishery and the changing politics around the fishery, a lot of these villages have lost a lot of their fishing quotas. So now, I mean, the population of the whole Westfjords is only like 6,000 or 7,000. Maybe 100 years ago, there would have been maybe 13,000, 14,000. So it's been the Westfjords have been struggling in many ways, you know, by depopulation. Ísafjörður has been relatively stable point because it's been really the only big town, and so and it has been a relatively stable town in the whole turmoil. But it's still an area that has been struggling by people moving away and not finding jobs and stuff. But on the other hand, it's a wild nature, and it's that fjordscape with sea and the mountains all always close together. There's practically no flat land anywhere. You're always pretty much straight from the mountains to the sea.
And it's not even like the area where we are now. It's only accessible by boat or by foot.
Yeah, so Hornstrandir, this nature reserve that we are in now, is the last people moved away from that whole peninsula in the 1940s and maybe the 1950s.
We actually see some houses.
Yeah, this is Hesteyri there, and the last people moved away in the 1950s. And in the end, there was a few families left, and they just had a town meeting where they all decided together to move away, to close the village. But like 30 years earlier than that, or 40 years, there was a whaling station just around the corner there, which you know, gave a lot of employment to the local people. But at that time, they probably realized that this would never be linked to the mainland with any good road connections. It didn't have the proper harbor facilities, and it didn't really have the natural landscape to facilitate good harbors. So it was pretty obvious that this would probably never survive that as a future community. So people ended up moving away, and now it's just nature that rules here.
But I mean, still, and I just learned this weekend talking to your son actually that there's villages that on the map are like close to each other, but still, like during the almost like 7 or 9 months a year, they cannot almost get to each other because the roads are closed over the mountains.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's still a highly separated and remote landscape. It is,
yeah. Yeah.
What are the changing of the seasons in this area? What is it? What happens and what does it mean?
Well, I mean, here is the winter is really rough, especially here in Hornstrand. It can be even worse than over in Ísafjörður. So it's just, in the winter, nothing is happening here. It's dark, you know, the middle of the winter is pretty dark and it's stormy. So, but then just spring will just kind of jump out, you know, in 4 weeks from now, grass will just come almost green from underneath the snow, and wildflowers and the birds are going to be everywhere. And it's amazing energy in the nature that short summer. And then, you know, it could start snowing again in September. So it's really 2 or 3 months of, you know, really powerful summer.
We've had some fantastic days on the boat this week. What can you like summarize, like what we have been doing here?
Well, this week started off with a bit of a stormy weather, and we are quite used to stormy periods coming any time of the year almost, but this has been a very long cold period now. This has been like 2 weeks of proper winter weather, and now it's like it's still minus degrees and it's fresh snow, and it also offers some opportunities. You know, we've been doing great skiing, you know, we've been doing a little bit of powder, and so it's been good skiing.
And what do you expect for tomorrow, the last working day of the week?
Yeah, it looks like a great day. I think it's going to be similar to what it was today. And actually, the next, you know, foreseeable forecast is seems to be relatively calm. Not necessarily so sunny, but pretty good, easy weather.
Do you have a clear vision, like where you want to take this company, like in the coming years?
Yes, I think no. Well, I don't know if I could say that I have a clear vision, but I want to continue roughly in the same path that I've already been laid. You know, I think I would be very interested in doing more of the, spending maybe more time in Greenland, doing a little bit more of the exploration, you know, going to some new places. But it's not like a big business that has a very strategic plan. You know, it's mostly about, you know, me and my family and my friends. And one day we may decide to take a U-turn and do something totally different. But at the moment, I think it's all about operating a boat or two boats or whatever we're going to end up with and exploring this area, kind of the North Atlantic, our home grounds, and inviting some people out to play with us.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you so much.
And the fox is barking.
And the fox is barking behind us.
Oh.
Thank you.
We come back to Ísafjörður just in time for the Fossavatn Ski Marathon, a cross-country race ranging from 10 up to 50 kilometers. I end up talking a bit to one of the older participants and a visitor from afar.
No problem. So who are you and where are you from?
My name is Peter Hoffman. I live near Toronto in Canada, a place near Waterloo, famous university there.
How come you ended up here in the Westfjords?
Well, I always wanted to visit Iceland because I enjoy maps, and I like the North, Vikings, all those things, Inuit. But it was very expensive until about 2007. And then in Dublin, I have a big story here. We were caught by the volcano, actually, in Dublin in 2010.
Oh, really?
So I looked again, and I said, oh, it's not so expensive anymore. And so this is actually number five time. It'll be number six on the way back. We're going to Westman. Since 2011, that my wife doesn't ski anymore, but and I've done a lot of world obstacles. I'm getting very old now, so I'm only doing 25 kilometers. Anyway, next question.
So what's your impression of the area coming here?
Well, Ísafjörður particularly is very beautiful. In fact, the whole island, and fortunately, my wife loves it too. She doesn't like the cold quite so much as I do, but. So we've been around the ring road. We're going to do it again this time, and we've been many places, but there's still some, like Westman Islands, and we never went to the big waterfall near Mývatn. We'll probably go there this time if the road is okay. So it's just fantastic. They have the phrase, a little bit impolite, that Iceland is a geologist's wet dream, and that's true, I'm sure. I'm not a geologist, although my father was a mining engineer, so I'm quite interested in that.
But what is it with the nature and everything that attracts you with this place?
Well, just about everything. I suppose the mountains. We always visit mountains in many places, New Zealand and Switzerland and so on. And actually, for a mountain country, the driving is... Much of the driving is quite easy. Some is a little... interesting, like near Latrobjerg last year, and we actually lived near Snæfellsjökull in a cottage for 8 weeks last year. So not just six times, but many, many weeks in Iceland, actually.
And what about this cross-country skiing? What do you like about it?
Well, I started only really, a little bit as a teenager, but hardly any. When I was in my 30s, and I like the people, especially at events like this, the races. So when I was younger, I did more races, but I'm still doing it quite a bit with the Masters skiers in Canada. I just like the people very much. Everybody's so, we compete on the course, but people help each other, and I like the winter. I think that it's probably close to the best exercise there is. So there's many things, and having a few races means you try to stay in shape. I roller ski in the summer, so that's basically But I only started racing when I was almost 50, really racing, not just going in events. And I think I'm pretty much finished trying to race and just enjoy the events now.
Have you been to Vasaloppet in Sweden?
Well, in 1988, I did the Oppet Spar. I didn't do the Vasaloppet itself. It was back in the 80s when I did many of these world loppets in Europe. And I haven't, except for Norway, where we have fans who are almost like family. They're not actually family. Near Oslo, Oscar, go there often. So I've done the Norwegian Birkebeiner maybe four times and caught by the no race with a wind a couple of years ago. Not last year, but the previous time. But I haven't. I've been through Sweden once or twice, but I've only done Vasaloppet once.
You get a favorite race?
Well, of course, I do the Canadian Gatineau probably 20 times. I've done the 50K there. But it's not necessarily my favorite. It's sort of different because I live there. I think maybe Norwegian Birkebeiner, even though I am very bad at climbing and classic. I'm better skating and in better, flatter courses, but it's a challenge. I was never good enough to get the pin there, but, you know, I like it.
So what do you feel for today, the race today?
I'm sorry, what?
What's your feelings for the race today with the weather?
Well, I'll take it easy at first. I've had a little bit of trouble with my abductor and my back or something. I want to make sure that's not bad. But this looks fine, you know, as long as it doesn't get windy. I think wind is probably a big problem here because of no trees. And it looks like it'll be good.
Just before I fly back to Reykjavik, I get to participate in something that serves as the perfect example of how alive and active the backcountry community is in such a small town as Ísafjörður. A local initiative to introduce and educate the teenagers of the town to backcountry skiing. Even though this particular session was meant to be girls only, they were kind enough to make an exception for the podcasting Swedish dude.
What was your name?
Camilla.
Why did you end up at Ísafjörður?
I came here 3 springs ago skiing. I had some friends over this way and I did a little bit of reading and I found out you're right by the ocean and there's a mountain there, so it sounded like my kind of place, so I came and I stayed around for a bit and then I left for about 6 months and then I came back and decided that I wanted to make this my home base.
What's your, what's your history? Because you've been around some skiing.
Yeah, I grew up in England, but then I moved to Switzerland at 15, so I was in the mountains then. And then I just kind of enjoyed the winters and skiing. So in the summer, I'd be like, well, what am I doing? And then I ended up going to Argentina so I could kind of feel the skiing in the winter. The never-ending winter, yeah. And then it was a lot of ski touring too rather than just, you know, skiing resorts. I just like the cultures and the travel through skiing.
Yeah, doing ski touring with horses in South America, I've heard.
Yeah. Just out there, we're lucky and unlucky here that there's no trees, so you can just drive and park and, you know, you climb up anything. Whereas down there, there's a lot of forest and a lot of, longer approaches. So we'd go out for a few weeks with horses and camp. And also, you can only carry so much food and tents. So, yeah, that's why we use the horses out that way.
What was the purpose of today's little exercise?
Well, I spent a lot of time in the Alps, so I'm used to seeing all the young people out skiing. And when I first came here, I realized that there's no one else out skiing, which was great. I mean, you've got the whole mountains to yourself, but I think it's important that the young kids realize, what they've got on their doorstep. And they're motivated. They're all cross-country skiers, so they're trained 6 times a week. You know, they've got the fitness, but they just don't have anyone to take them out. So I think it's... It's fun to see who's interested, and yeah, it seems to be that there's people wanting to do it. So,
but this was the first event.
We took some girls out the other day, and they were the ones from the downhill, ski team. So, the girls today were from the cross country team. Mm. So,
well, what's the long term ambition for this?
Just to keep trying to do it as much as possible, and hopefully these girls will then inspire the younger girls, and just a chain effect. I want to see young people doing stuff. Like, it gets a bit depressing when you're the only person out and just trying to motivate yourself. Like, I mean, the weather can be terrible here, so, you know, there's only so much skiing in the rain you can do alone, whereas if you've got people with you, then it's, like, it's fun.
Also, I have to ask you, because I, as an outsider,
yeah,
what's it like getting into the Ísafjörður community and the backcountry and the outdoor community?
So when I first came, I was with a Boria, a guides company. We were staying out in a farmhouse, and when I was staying out there, I thought it was a cool project, so I volunteered my time to help. So I feel, yeah, I just got in with the community. I met the first intros, and it's a very small community of outdoor enthusiasts, so they're very responsive for people coming in. Like I am now, like I'm localish now, and when anyone comes to ski, I'm very happy to take them out, because I think otherwise you're alone.
Seems like a very alive and like closely tight-knit community, though. Like in a good way, I mean.
Yeah, it's in a good way. And I think the way we are like geographically located, we've kind of on our own little island out here. We can be, you know, this winter's been a really tough winter. Like the flights haven't been going, the roads have been closed. So we are like this little, yeah, this little world to ourselves. So, you know, before, like if you're in a ski town, you can find the people who you're exactly alike and hang out with them. But here, you know, there's only a few people. So you end up meeting people that you probably wouldn't normally be friends with, and it opens your eyes to lots of different worlds, and we try and encourage each other with different sort of passions and hobbies, so it's pretty cool.
So what does the rest of your season look like?
Well, it seems to be never ending. I was skiing in October and like down in Chile, and now I'm like, yeah, it's been a long winter. I'm just hoping we get some spring days, because we haven't really. But I've got friends coming out at the end of May, so it'd be fun to for it to still be good snow then. But I assume, yeah, I think June will still be skiing and stuff too. It depends what happens with the weather. But, yeah.
The days on the Aurora Arctica was the experience I was looking for. Skiing will not get much better than this. With a floating headquarters packed with skis, kayaks, and stand-up paddleboards, and with Siggy at the helm, there is simply no better way to experience the mountains and the fjords. I'm also very grateful to have discovered the wonderful town of Ísafjörður, where people live their lives not even owning a key to their own house. Where the local ski resort opens up the lift just for you, offering you 2 hours of non-stop powder skiing. This is a place for anyone brave or wise enough to hop off the daily routines and spend a week or a couple of months in the lovely town of Ísafjörður, where skiing, friendship, and adventures lies just around the corner. If you listen to this episode using the Acast podcast app, you will also see some pictures and links along the way. Find out more about this episode and about the Aurora Arctica at huskypodcast.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the handle huskypodcast.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.